The following podcast contains explicit language.
Give it up, please, for red-haired strangers. I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gap Fest live from Edition. It's Wednesday, June 6, 2018. On today's show, Samantha Bee has unleashed a firestorm. We discuss the state of political speech in an age of political rage and the special radioactive power of the F word, feckless. And then Book Club is the new movie starring Jane Fonda, Diane Keaton, Candace Bergen, and Mary Steenburgen, Soft Steenburgen, about four women whose choice of 50 Shades of Grey for their book club alters each of their lives. And finally, Philip Roth, the last of the great white male titans of post-war American fiction, has died. We discuss his legacy and then commit a giant act of group book club with you all, I believe, using his 1979 novella, The Ghostwriter. And then an extra special sort of fourth segmenty treat, special guest, multi-instrumentalist, musician extraordinaire, songwriter extraordinaire, and I'm happy to announce, recently knighted as a fop. That's fresh friend of the program, Franz Nicolai, will play a song or two. Give it up for Franz Nicolai. Hold steady. And various solo projects. All right, joining me today is Slate's editor, Julia Turner. Hey, Julia.
Hello, Steve.
And, yes?
I'm just, it's nice here.
You
I just want to acknowledge.
You like the smell of runnels of blood?
I mean, I guess at some point we will divulge where we are, right? Or is this a secret forever?
We're going to banter after I introduce Dana Stevens, Slate's film critic. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Steve.
Okay, so now we do have a question that we need to answer, which is, are we going to reveal... I mean, these guys signed a comically unenforceable non-disclosure agreement. They're not allowed to say, but I suppose we can unilaterally break it and say where we are. But I kind of think, like, if you didn't pay up and come... You're just sticking a couple of earbuds in each canal and listening. Why do you deserve to know where the Culture Gab Fest is right now? You don't.
This is a pivot in your position from when you were desperately trying to goad me and Dana into being curious about what this place is.
I had no...
So that you could tell everybody on the podcast.
I knew... I was three... This is chess, not checkers, Julia. And I was three moves ahead of you. I knew you were going to play this game of asking me, and I was going to refuse valiantly. And...
Wait, what? That's not the game that was played.
Maybe it is checkers. All right, are we going to disclose or no?
Yes.
All right, well, first of all, before we say the name, does it live up to the hype?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's just not even close, right? It's not even close. This place is amazing.
It's like a magical Brigadoon. It's like a Beer-a-Dune.
It's Beer-a-Dune. It's like when you have the dream... where there's an annex in your house that you've never been to, and you're like, this is amazing. It goes on forever and ever. This is marvelous. And then you wake up in your studio apartment on Avenue B. But I thought I'd never been to this part. This isn't part of Columbia County where I live, but it's right next to it and might as well be. And I just, when I pulled in here, I was like, this is, we have to do a live show here. Where are we?
We are at a farm / brewery called S&S Farm Brewery. Right?
Yeah, we are exactly there, yeah. And sort of, are we in Malden Bridge or are we in Nassau? I think we're technically in Nassau. In Nassau, New York. You got to come here, but you got to come here at the right time or else you're SOL. It's open on Friday nights and I think now on Saturday nights too. And it's a hootenanny. It's Suds, music, and food trucks, and it's worth seeking out. All right. To all the people I told it was okay to bring your kids, this is an all ages experience. I'm so sorry. As you no doubt know, Samantha Bee, host of Full Frontal, did a segment on the immigration policy that separates children from their parents. She flashed the now infamous photo of Ivanka with her kid, then asked the first daughter to, quote, do something about her father's immigration policy, you feckless, and here the transcript breaks off suddenly. I can't say the word... Julia, I guess I'll start with you. I can't say the word, but that would surprise my English friends. They use it liberally. In fact, we have, can I get a witness? Right? It signifies a completely different way in the United Kingdom than it does here. And yet in this country, it joins a select very select, very small group of words that are considered almost ultimately toxic and unacceptable to use. Yay or nay? Are you with me or against me?
Yeah, it's in the borderlands, but it's particularly when used as pejorative to describe a woman. It's pretty far out of bounds, I think, in polite conversation or even widely acceptable impolite conversation.
But depending on the speaker, right? I mean, then we have to get into the category of who can say what, which are we going to have that conversation?
I think we should get into it. I mean, I think the important distinction to make initially is that it's a term of ultimate, it has been construed as a term of ultimate misogynistic abuse in the United States and is a shocking word, I think. Whereas it's a much more, it's a somewhat common way to describe, I think, especially sort of hateful public figures, right? The Brexit crew. I mean, one looks at them and thinks, right?
See you next Tuesday.
Clearly Samantha Bee was using it in the more English context, but is being held to account for its other connotations.
Well, I mean, I think she was well aware of maybe she was not aware of the government getting in on the act, but I'm sure that she was aware that it was not a word that would be usually used on her show, although I did read somewhere that it had been used once before on Full Frontal on her show about Woodrow Wilson, and no one complained. let's get into the question of who says what and what it means if they say it. I mean, of course, we can all agree, like, this word is a taboo word in the United States. Okay, great. But taboos exist in a context, right? I mean, there's the question of what community can speak a word. And there were obviously opinions flying around about this all of last week online. And one that I kept seeing was, you know, some attempt to balance this word with a word like the N-word, right? Which is a word that some communities can use or one community can use and communities outside of that can't use. And there's a lot of anxiety about sort of that word within the Black community as well. I think there was a great documentary called The N-Word that came out a few years ago that interviewed different people about their attitude toward that word. And I remember that Samuel Jackson, as you can imagine, was one interviewee who was comfortable with that word, who said, it's our word, we can use it, you know, it's sort of our power to take it back. And then there were other speakers who said, no, although I'm a Black person, I would like that word to disappear, and I don't use it myself. And I think the C word might occupy some kind of space like that, too. So there is clearly a difference between a man, right? What if Trevor Noah had uttered that word, right? Or another mm-hmm. late night host mm-hmm. who was not a woman. It would have a different valence and I think would seem more hateful, right?
Oh, without question, it cannot be used even in that context, right, by a male host. I totally agree.
But then we should also acknowledge the bad faith of listeners who refuse to acknowledge that fact and treat that word as if it's some sort of you know, nuclear button that you push and everything explodes.
Well, we're also ignoring the huge exception, which is if you're describing Woodrow Wilson, who was a total... I won't do it.
But wait, you guys are just like pussyfooting around the question of like, do you think Sam B should have used the word? I want to hear what you guys actually think.
You want to go first?
Okay. Having given this a lot of thought, let me put it this way, as a first pass, I'm shocked by, not in a negative or positive way, by the amount of support Samantha Bee is getting from surprising quarters, right? So the completely full-throated defense of the use of it by Rebecca Traister and my wife, for example, right? We're living in this peculiar political era where everything is totally surprising, bordering on shocking, and everything is totally predictable as well. And so the use of it is calculated to shock, but all the reactions subsequently are totally predictable, right? The right wing goes into a total seizure. The president tweets. The demand is made that she be fired. The completely grotesque dragging in of the purchase of Time Warner by AT&T, which the implication being that Trump may withhold approval, or his Justice Department may withhold approval for the merger on the basis of not firing Samantha Bee, is entering into a realm of total political perversity in a way.
Although that's not actually how that merger works or would get approved, right?
The head of American state shouldn't be even threatening or implying the threat of it, I find it hard to separate the use of the word from the subsequent sort of kabuki seizure that everyone goes into subsequently, which is regrettable. I would push us eventually in the direction of a thought experiment. Laura Ingraham calls Michelle Obama the C word. The next day, we're asking for Laura Ingraham to be fired.
I'm not sure we are. I mean, that was the point that David French, or a similar point was made by David French in National Review, saying, you know, what if Sean Hannity had used that term about Michelle Obama? And there would have been outrage, but there were a lot of false equivalencies, I think, drawn this week because of this happening on the heels of Roseanne Barr's Ambien tweet and use of an unforgivable slur around Valerie Jarrett and the subsequent very surprising cancellation of her show, which was a response I think a lot of people didn't anticipate from ABC, which they did. But I actually think that the response here, that was kind of out of line, apologize, don't have your show canceled, is about the right response. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure she needed to apologize. I mean, and I'm curious whether you guys think the apology was overdrawn, because I don't actually think it was unforgivable or terrible. She meant what she said. She was trying to say that Ivanka was heartless and complicit and all the other things that people try to say in their critiques. But it just was lazy. Like, my mm-hmm. concerns about it were aesthetic, not moral. You should make your, even jokes, you should use evidence and make an argument and not just use invective. And it just, like, invective as argument is weak and lazy. And honestly, it's what I don't love about CNB's show, which I think is a little bit of, like, rah-rah liberal grousing. And it's why I don't watch it.
Okay, you want to hear what I think? Okay, so remember our discussion about Michelle Wolf at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, right? I think this is somewhat analogous to that situation, not as outrageous. The fact that Sam B and TBS both apologized, I think, fully and completely, and there was nothing, there were, unlike Roseanne Barr, they didn't get on and, you know, whatever, take it back that night in some sort of new insane rant. It was a decent apology. She probably shouldn't have used that word just so as not to offer this ammo up to the right. But she should definitely not have apologized. I think there should be no ground whatsoever conceded to the real obscenity, which is, you know, the president trying to invoke his power to cancel out the First Amendment and fire individuals and intervene in the media. That is the obscenity. And I think the answer from Sam B and from future, you know, comedians at correspondence dinners who outrage people and anyone whose nasty little language upsets the right should just be, it should be like Michael Corleone in The Godfather. Remember when he said, mm-hmm. my offer to you is nothing. That is exactly what we should offer to them. Right? I mean, yeah, fine. She overstepped. It was an insulting word. It was too insulting. But the person she's talking about is complicit in gross human rights abuses. And that is an obscenity in itself that one is likely to overreact to when one is a comedian trying to express and channel public outrage. I mean, the things that they're doing are so obscene that it's natural that there are going to be these eruptions of obscenity into the public sphere. And the idea that that has anything to do with something like what Roseanne Barr was doing, not just with that one tweet, but with like the crazy conspiracy theory stuff she's been sending out. I mean, the stuff that they're doing is dangerous and harmful to actual living beings. Mm-hmm. So I could really give a crap, right? I should use a much stronger word than that. I could give a anything, whatever worse word you want to substitute.
A nothing. I mean, I hear you, absolutely. But I also am not sure that the apology compromises the outrage of the left. Like, to me, the apology suggests a higher road a little bit. Like, all right, well, I'm a fair-minded individual. I was making a bunch of jokes. I made a joke that was, like, a little bit cheaper than it was smart and efficacious, so I'll apologize for it, and then I'll move on and continue to make my jokes. Like, to me, the apology does not undermine the intent of the joke or like the cause of the left or I don't know. Like it doesn't feel like the hill to die on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I see what you're saying, but I think that probably that should come at the front end, you know, of maybe trying to not stray into this world of, like you say, personal invective and kind of taboo insults so that you don't have to apologize. Because if we were dealing with rational actors, Julia, I would agree with you. But look what the White House does with it. 24 hours later, they're calling for a private company to fire an individual because of it.
But I mean, you know, so maximally hateful things are happening out in the world. As a correlative, something is brewing inside us that's ugly. I mean, I think that's the thing that I most resent about an era like this, is that my own worst impulses, my own political id, my own desire for revenge is on a constant low boil. And then there's this need for exorcism in our pop culture, specifically comedy, late night comedy, pseudo news shows, a, you know, function that's been performed now for 10, 15 years by John Stewart and now Samantha Bee. And so I certainly felt the power of it because that is a word that has occurred in my interior life with sudden frequency. But I also think as a liberal, you believe in the veil of ignorance, right? Like you think in terms of abstract and universal terms about, is that word acceptable? What would it be like if someone used it to describe someone I admired, you know, even if that person had been a woman? So I can only cut this baby exactly in half. I mean, I cannot really settle my own mind. I think she should have just called her a Nigel Farage, who is the perfect. All right, moving on.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Book Club is a Golden Girl We Still Got It romp-com starring, thank you, starring Annie Hall, Murphy Brown, Barbarella, and Mary Steenburgen. That was the real joke. As successful women in early senior citizenry who've gathered for 40 years once a month for to hold a book club, they began in the 1970s with Erica Jong's Fear of Flying. And they're now getting their groove back by reading 50 Shades of Grey. This revs up their libidos while placing novel demands on their loved and unloved ones. The movie also stars Golden Boys Andy Garcia, Craig T. Nielsen, and Don Johnson.
I would like to introduce you to Christian Grey.
Oh no.
Well, it was a bestseller made into a movie.
Oh, and that is our theme this year.
We are not reading this.
It's my month. When it's your month, you can choose whatever boring, depressing book you want.
To even be holding this book is embarrassing. Who's judging you, your cat?
I do like the idea of a romance.
We are too old.
But it says right here for mature audiences.
Oh, yeah, so. That certainly sounds like us.
We started this book club to stimulate our minds.
Well,
from what I hear, this book is quite stimulating.
Oh, God.
Come on, let's toast to our new book.
All right. Oh, we're good.
Voice that flash.
Yeah.
Happy reading, ladies.
Why don't we start with you, Dana? You're the film critic. What did you think?
Oh, you know, I really wanted to love this movie more than I did, but it's sweet. It's sweet and gentle and often funny, but almost never funny because of the scripted dialogue, which is sort of a shame for a comedy. I mean, wouldn't you agree? What's funny about it is the interaction of the three women, the seemingly improvised love scenes at times between Andy Garcia and Diane Keaton, I think is one of the high points of the movie. It's super charming, total chemistry together. And really, they all almost do seem to be making up their dialogue as they go along. But man, what a loosely structured comedy. This is like a first pass at a draft of a script.
I know.
And the book club conceit is so poorly woven into the various developments in their lives that it might as well not be called book club and not have any E.L. James, you know, angle at all. It's essentially about, yeah, four women getting their groove back, as you say, and sort of coming together to talk about it, but yeah.
So other than the premise, the dialogue, the characters, the plot structure, the script, and should we throw in the directing?
Yeah,
you kind of liked it.
Like, put it this way, it's not a Nancy Meyers movie. It's not directed by Nancy Meyers. It's directed by Bill Holderman, who I believe is making his first
film.
This
is a debut, yeah.
And he co-wrote the script as well. And it's sort of, yeah, it feels like Nancy Meyers without the polish, without the sophistication. You know, I mean,
it's
Nancy Meyers
with
like Ernst Lubitsch in comparison.
Insane use of green screen. My favorite scene is where Diane Keaton and Andy Garcia are like flying in his like rich boy single engine vintage plane through like just a flight simulator of Red Rock Desert, like behind them, like
I know,
around.
and then the actual Sedona footage is just a drone, right? Some realtor probably loaned it to him.
Yeah, it's a travesty. I mean, it's just so it's a travesty, not because it's bad and terrible. It's a travesty because it's such an insult to women of this generation. It's so clearly an executive's concept for a movie that would do money. You know, it's like, yeah. Oh, yeah, like who still goes to the movies? Who still knows what the movies are? Old ladies. Who are these some good actresses? Oh, there's some good older actresses. Like, let's put them and sex in a movie and like throw it all in a blender and they'll buy tickets. And like nobody seems to have given it more thought than that. And the performances that these women give are so poignant because they're all such powerhouses, yeah. Right? They all are in slightly different movies, but still, it's like fun to see them watching. It's fun to watch them doing what they do, except for Diane Keaton, who I would say, despite sort of loving her style and many of the performances she's given, and even the sort of way in which her flightiness works in Nancy Meyers movies, she was like a complete caricature of herself, like constantly fluttering her hands around and awkwardly.
I just love Diane Keaton so much that I don't care. I want to see her do that in every movie. But her character was not a her kind of character at all. Has anybody out here seen Book Club? Yeah? Yeah. That's right.
Clap if you saw Book Club.
Clap if you saw it. Okay,
really? Clap if you liked Book Club. Okay. Was that, please tell me that was Daniel?
It was Daniel.
That's awesome.
I mean, I personally, I had an Annie Hall poster in my high school bedroom. I'm such a Diane Keaton stan that I would just watch her kind of be on screen, and that's really exactly what she does in this movie. But you know who, I'll see if you all agree, who was the surprise MVP of this movie?
Andy Garcia.
He was fantastic, but of the women.
Oh, for me, it's a toss-up, but we'll see who that puppy voted for. I think that Candace Bergen and Mary Steenburgen
Candace
were great.
Bergen. It was Candace Bergen.
She's great. Yeah. Yeah.
She's just funny. Her reaction shots were great. I was never a Murphy Brown watcher or a particular Candace Bergen fan, and she really kind of stole my heart in this movie.
Right. So I love the way both of you blew past my second question, which was, Julia, empowering or condescending? And it's like literally three quarters of a mile in my rearview mirror, but maybe I'll throw in my answer. First of all, I laughed twice. Second of all, I would have loved this movie, loved it, had I been on an airplane, and even more had the airplane been piloted by Andy Garcia. I walked out just so gooey-eyed for him. He's just so, I was like, why doesn't every movie have Andy Garcia in it? Whereas I used to be a why does any movie have Andy Garcia in it guy.
He is like manic pixie pilot boy, though, a little bit. Like, he's not, his courtship by Diane Keaton is for her to sit next to him, bop into the plane in an incomprehensible manner like a freakazoid, have her suddenly grab his crotch and giggle about it, and he's in love. Which I didn't find super flawless.
Well, and the Don Johnson Jane Fonda romance has the exact same. I mean, I guess it's sort of payback, equal payback for decades and decades and decades of female characters, love interests like that, right? But they're all just handsome, uxorious men who are hanging on the woman's every word.
Wait, can I tell you about the most ill? Sorry, see, finish your point.
No,
I'm just going to sit here and be handsome and uxorious.
All right, well, then I'll continue. The most ill-used man in the movie, all right, so Candace Bergen goes on Bumble and has a couple dates, and in them, she has a date with Richard Dreyfuss, which turns hot and heavy, and then she has a date with Wallace Shawn. So she dates Richard Dreyfuss, who is, like, shorter than her, balding, portly, but has a kind face. Somehow he's portly in this movie. Anyway, and they make out, and the seal is broken. Hooray for Candace. And then she goes on another date with Wallace Shawn, another short, balding,
we are getting
slightly
so much mail.
Dense, but like an equally lovely elder gentleman of Hollywood.
Whatever.
And it's like, oh, grotesque. I couldn't possibly. And it's like so embarrassing that she's at a bar with Wallace Shawn and she meets Ed Begley and her ex-husband and his model girlfriend. Like, poor Wallace Shawn.
Yeah, that was a horrific use of Wallace Shawn. He's also so funny. I was waiting for the payoff scene, right? I mean, when is there going to be some second hilarious scene with Wallace Shawn and he just disappears?
So this
movie was just absolutely all over the place. N'importe quoi.
Totally non-structured. It was like having an infield of, all stars and just watching them toss it around the horn. It was sort of fun in that regard. I saw it on a Friday matinee, I think. It's today, Saturday, Thursday matinee. I can't remember now. I think it was yesterday, Friday matinee, with a, you know, quarter-fold house of Golden Girls.
Well, did they like it? Because one charming thing is that
they were so het up by this movie.
My audience loved it too, and that was the funnest part.
3 minutes in, it was like whooping, hollering, like, you go girl. I mean, it really was.
The guy behind me
it was a revival.
Can you believe Jane Fonda is 80? Her body is incredible. No, which it is.
It was a revival tent, and who's going to naysay it? I mean, in a way, like, yes, Nancy Meyer. It did make me. I mean, I didn't believe a movie could make me pine for Andy Garcia. It's even more improbable one could make me pine for the autorial touch of Nancy Meyers. But I was like, 2 minutes in, I was like, God, I hope this is a Nancy Meyers joint. I mean, she'll bring the ship home. And it wasn't tightly crafted, but it was kind of crudely
raffishly
effective.
I really wish the Nancy Meyers version of this had existed. That, to me, that's the condescending. It's like some exec had this idea for a Nancy Meyers movie, but then didn't go to the trouble of getting a Nancy Meyers or Nancy Meyers caliber person to make it in terms of the structure and storytelling. And so you have these like glimmers of absolute like epical brilliance in these actresses, all of whom are capable of extraordinary things, and most of the men do. And then just like strange, uncanny valley touches. For some reason, Diane Keaton's daughters are played by Alicia Silverstone and Katie Azleton, and she has two for no reason that the plot requires, other than it allows the two women to kind of cock their heads simultaneously like spaniels looking perplexed at Diane Keaton. Like, they look lobotomized. The whole thing, I mean, I would sort of recommend it because it's so weird.
I mean, I was mostly listening to that, but there's the dogs, so cute, and there's beer and sunshine. I agree with every word you just said.
I'm sure you do.
Are we exiting the segment now? I believe we are. The movie is, I'm sorry, did I offend you?
No.
Okay. The movie is Book Club. It's got a certain kind of charm. We're split on it, I think. Break the tie. Go to facebook.com/culturefest. Tell us what you thought of it. Moving on. All right, I'm going to quote one of my favorite writers, Chip McGrath of the New York Times, said, "Mr. Roth was the last of the great white males. The triumvirate of writers Saul Bellow and John Updike were the others who towered over American letters in the second half of the 20th century." I agree with that judgment, so I thought I'd just quote it outright. In the course of his remarkable career, Philip Roth won 2 National Book Awards, 2 National Book Critics Circle Awards, 3 Penn Faulkner Awards, a Pulitzer Prize, and famously not the Nobel Prize. And apparently, as he was in the hospital, people would come, he was in the hospital when Bob Dylan won the Nobel Prize, and people were like, I'm gonna go see Philip, you know, he must be really down about this. And apparently one person walked in after the other and he had the same joke ready for all of them. He said, "Did you hear? I was just admitted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame." Philip Roth's novels are about growing up Jewish in post-war America, being a man leading up to the sexual revolution. They're about assimilation, rebellion against it, America's tendency to political psychosis, the sheer diversity and inexplicability of humanity, about literature itself, as the book we read is about. I think his career breaks up roughly into 3 periods. There's kind of an early Roth, a middle Roth, and a late. Well, the early one was coming of age in northern New Jersey within a Jewish enclave in the post-war years, and what it's like to be both totally at home in that and to break away from it, to feel the pressure of breaking away from it. And then there's a late period, sort of the period of American pastoral and human stain, where he retired, actually not too far from here, retired in the sense of moved away from New York City, but doubled down on being a writer and a great writer. And there he wrote masterpieces like American Pastoral. In the exact middle of his career, I would say, roughly, is The Ghostwriter, which we'll eventually talk about. But before we get there, I want to just... People have not mild reactions to Philip Roth, and I'm curious what your not mild reaction is, Dana.
Oh, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but mine is kind
totally
of mild.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm only qualified for this conversation because we all read The Ghostwriter and we can talk about that substantially together. But really, the Roth that I know is so balanced toward the early end of his career that I can't speak to what's supposed to be the great flowering of his his career, which is that period, the mid-90s period, I think, of American mm-hmm. pastoral and Sabbath. What's the Mickey Sabbath book?
Sabbath Theater.
Yeah.
95.
All the books I've read by him are from the first half and ending with this one. So it would be Goodbye Columbus, his first novella, Portnoy's Complaint, of course, Letting Go, I've read, which is, I think, maybe his fourth or fifth novel, and now this, The Ghostwriter. So really, I know that young Nathan Zuckerman character, the kid from New Jersey, that writer I know. But when he started to get more into these big, sprawling political novels that were kind of speculative fictions about America, which sound fantastic, I can't speak to them.
Some of them are amazing. But you don't have a hair on fire. Why are we discussing that horrible misogynist?
No, not at all. In fact, and I thought this reading The Ghostwriter too, I mean, it's true that he doesn't have protagonists who are women, right? He writes men and he writes about men living in worlds of men. But I thought both the female characters in this book were beautifully drawn.
Right, yeah.
And that, as we'll get to when we talk about it more substantially, that the ways in which the two female characters in the story were, you know, shut down and oppressed and their lives made more difficult by the men. I think he wrote that really well.
You're getting ahead of us. All right, Julia, what do you think?
Well, so I have sort of the flip side version to Dana in my experiences with Roth, which is that I've read more of the late stuff, American Pastoral, Plot Against America, a few others from that period, and, you know, found him to be great, but not like my guy, if that makes sense. Like, mm-hmm. and in some ways, I think I read him and Updike and held them in my mind at the same time as these really interesting, in some ways similar, in some ways quite different explorations of being a man in America in the second half of the 20th century, reckoning with the disruptions of the first half, and then really wanting to have sex with women, which is like interesting to read about when you're a woman who does not walk around through a gauze of male lust in my perspective on everything. And so both reading both of them, you're like, oh, is this what happens in men's brains? Interesting. Like, I read both of them as like a young woman, like in my teens and 20s, and was not, in a funny way, I think the Roth use of lust feels like it has more perspective on that lust, at least as I was reacquainted with it in The Ghostwriter, which we'll get to in a moment, than the Updike, which is maybe a little bit rabbitier. But I don't know. I think that's my Roth preamble.
Fair enough. Now, should we proceed to the book club?
Yeah, this is a never been done before experiment, guys. So we sent you an email. We asked you to read The Ghostwriter. Have any of you read The Ghostwriter in the last week and or the last decades of your life? Clap if you have read The Ghostwriter.
Wow.
All right.
All right, so is Red-Haired Stranger around? We thought if someone wanted to play some music while people broke off into groups, had their own mini book club, and then we were going to ask each book club to say who they thought the hero of the novel was in order to inspire me to say in staccato fashion, wrong!
And we will reconvene.
Well, that's fine.
Goodbye Columbus is really my favorite.
Yeah.
But I thought it was...
When I was young, I read three of his books, like right now, when they came out.
Yeah, we all read Portnoy's Complaint,
when I was 20-something, they were like, holy crap, you know, this is incredible. You know, he's really talking about what's going on.
The way that Manov is so lauded and the way that Hope I found to be really, really fun in how she pushed back against him. Like, I found myself, I don't know if I'd call her the hero, but like really drawn to her.
The fact that this book is about coming of age of an author, that it's sort of about discovering the power of authorship. And that if anyone's the hero, it's not Nathan Zuckerman the man, maybe it's Nathan Zuckerman the author. That this is like, you know.
But, all right, so on Steve's question of who the hero is, what do you think?
So, for me, the hero was Lossoff's wife. Because she had to put up with his total absorption and his creativity for 30 years.
You had any good conversations? I've had some extremely, extremely good conversations. A lot of people read it and took it seriously and have really super smart things to say. Plus, people are psyched to be here. The sun came out. We didn't know that it would. The beer is great. The band's shredding. It's really fun. It's a good day. So, yeah.
right. This is what I take to be a reputable summary of The Ghostwriter, published 1979 by Philip Roth. Since you have read it, correct me as I go. Off we go. A young writer who is clearly the alter ego of the author, named Nathan Zuckerman, goes to visit an older and eminent Jewish writer in the Berkshires. He ends up spending the night, which was not his initial plan. I'm going to throw this out there. I actually think I know the answer, but I'm not sure that I do. Isaac Bashevis Singer is who Lanoff is supposed to be. Now, when I read it 20 years ago, I thought it was Malibu, but then he talks about these short stories that are kind of old world, but actually in the new world, and maybe it's a composite. And then the other would-be possible spiritual literary father is Bellow, maybe?
Oh, the guy with the shiny suit is definitely
Bellow. Yes, is Bellow.
Right.
Okay. During the evening, the two discuss the joy of literature, the agony of trying to create it, the joy of reading it and the agony of trying to create it. The narrator then witnesses a domestic scene, a fight between the older man and his Yankee wife that is miserable but dense with implied but withheld meanings. He falls sort of in love with the older man's protege, assistant amanuensis, and possibly lover. The book is so slender and yet so narratively impacted with wisdom, meaning, humor, history, personal and otherwise. It's also, for being so densely packed, it's also completely filled with light and air. It doesn't feel heavy. It takes on absolutely no heaviness whatsoever.
We just spent a lovely bluegrassy few minutes discussing the book with a bunch of you, and it was delightful. And we want to go around to a few people who can name who they think is the hero of the book, and then we will entertain Steve's query. Who wants to tell Ben?
I think it's Hope.
I'm so screwed.
We should identify
you,
Hope.
I thought you were going to go around and say Anne Frank, Nathan Zucker, blah, 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 father, the mother. And I was going to say wrong. And then this great reveal, I was going to say Hope. But you're all going to say Hope, apparently.
Well, who was not going to say Hope? So who is it then?
Wait.
We thought it was
going to
be Nathan.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's an argument to be made that he's, you know, he's a flawed hero, but he's the hero. He's certainly the protagonist and the narrator and the person whose brain we spend the most time inside.
I mean, he's the hero in the sense that he learns how to write that book, right? Exactly. And the journey, by implication, culminates in the ability to render perfectly the experience.
No, another little sneaky preamble that you don't notice when you're starting out, just like the passage you read, Dana, is that the book begins with the phrase, "It was the last daylight hour of a December afternoon more than 20 years ago." So there's a incredible awareness of his self coming up against his idol, and he seems very astute about how awkward and sweaty and panicky he is. But you sort of forget in the reading of the book that it's actually 20 years distance.
Right,
that's
so
allowed
it's a
43-year-old. Him to be so astute.
Yeah.
But it's another little hidden gem. It's also why I would not just say that you can make the argument that Nathan is the hero, but I, in fact, would make that argument. So we can fisticuffs.
I mean, can I just say one thing about the lionization of Hope is kind of a 21st century argument. Like, I don't think that even the most astute literary critic in 1979 would have said that the hero is Hope, who, if you haven't read the book, is the Yankee wife, the put upon Yankee wife, who is just so perfectly sketched in her miserable life of tending to every need of this.
Yeah, she's
wait.
Writer.
Can we not wait 20 years to make the 21st century argument? Why is Hope the hero, Steve?
So the book is about the cost exacted by Lanoff on himself for devoting a life to creating sentences. What Lanoff talks about is how his entire life is structured around the possibility that good sentences will come out when he's at the typewriter. Everything is subordinate to it. The key thing that's subordinate to it is his wife. And it's clear that he, over the period of 20 or 30 years that he's been in the Berkshires, has slowly driven her completely crazy. Not because he's demanding principally, though that's certainly part of it, but that he is so nobly self-abnegating that he refuses every blandishment of life on behalf of both of them, but he produces something so fine-spun, perfect, and of world literary and historic importance that it's a worthwhile trade-off. And as the book goes on, you see and hear the broken nerves over and over again of this suppressed, woman who's traded an entire life to not herself be the author. And it's actually her suffering that's the martyred suffering, because he made a trade. And he constantly says the trade was worth it. I traded the succor of life, the succulence of life, in order to be literarily great. And she didn't make the freaking trade. And I think I was surprised at how much I thought Roth was absolutely in control of that part of the narrative this time reading it, my third or fourth or whatever it is time reading it, in part because they're so oblivious to her suffering as suffering when she's trying to make her escape. And they're saying, and she can't get the Ford to start, the car to start, in order to complete the dramatic exit from the marriage. And Lanoff is like, you know, Nathan is like, what do you think? Is it the battery? You know, and they start making guy talk. And it's clearly Roth telling you these two are monstrously inhuman and totally insensitive to the actual suffering in front of them in a way that I, now the grown-up Philip Roth, am not.
I'm not sure the fact that Nathan Zuckerman is an asshole means he's not the hero, though. Like, it's clear that Hope's suffering is very deliberately sketched, and the moral stakes of the book, but the fact that she's martyred, I mean, the best case for your argument, I think, or the best,
excuse me, for our argument, Julia, proceed.
Well, the best piece of evidence for your argument is the line at the end when they're having the guy talk, and she storms off by foot because she can't get the car to start, and walks down this icy, snowy drive. And he kind of buttons up into his coat and goes out after her and says, it's like being married to Tolstoy, as though she's this kind of tumultuous, wild, brilliant talent that he, you know, that she's really the protagonist. And
I thought he meant it's like for her, it's like being married to Tolstoy, because Tolstoy was a monstrous husband who fobbed everything off on his wife and servants.
I think that, I don't know, I'm not sure. I think you can read that the other way. But I don't know. To me, the whole Anne Frank saga suggests that what we're supposed to be thinking about here, and what's central, is the artist's awakening and reckoning, and the other monstrous thing that Zuckerman does. That's you know, I think people often talk about Roth and how he scandalized the Jewish community and was criticized by many among them for Portnoy's complaint as just being kind of a lusty embarrassment. But he literally is like, Anne Frank lied and harmed her dad because she was so stoked about being a great artist and had such pride in her sentences and didn't want to be connected to the burden of her past and didn't want to always be a victim. And it's both like a morally serious and actually interesting question, I think, to raise, and also completely sacrilegious and insane.
Although she says she's doing it for world Jewry as well, right? I mean, she essentially says, like, I'm not going to ever get in touch with Otto Frank again, because otherwise my book will not be...
Yes. Well, in the self-justification of the young, of the 20 years future author reflecting back on his young self, figuring out what it would mean to spurn your past in that way.
Right.
But she's fodder, and her story is fodder for his artistic awakening. And the fact that that's monstrous, I think, doesn't necessarily make him not our hero.
All right. We would love it if you came to facebook.com/culturefest, told us about Philip Roth. Do you have a skin reaction to him? Have you read The Ghostwriter? Are we all wrong? Who's the hero? On and on and on. But now I'm going to introduce a musician I admire to no end. Keyboardist for the Hold Steady, maker of incredible solo music, multi-instrumentalist, a virtuoso.
Sometime guest of our show.
Sometimes, and also, that's the other thing. I hate it when people who are brilliant at something I can't do at all also write better than me. That's grotesque. Franz Nicolai.
I am Franz Nicolai. I would say my primary qualification for being here is I live in the neighborhood, actually. I think it's safe to say I would have been here anyway, just as a fan of the show. I'll give you a tight two songs, because I don't want to overstay my welcome. I'll make it a nice little arc of a relationship between us. This is a song about limited expectations. If you go into any situation with low expectations, you have a pretty good chance of coming out of almost every situation in a state of pleasant surprise. And to the lay observer, that's almost indistinguishable from happiness. Here's a song about that. This is not a chair. That is not a table. This is not a cup. That is not a kettle. It is not raining. My shoe is not untied. I have not been unhappy my whole life. This is not a wall. That is not a ceiling. True. It's not a scrape. And I don't know that feeling. Not a spoon, not dirty dishes. Not a knife. I have not been unhappy my whole life. And all the lies I've ever told will come back to me one day. If this rain keeps coming, we can wash the world away. All the lies I've ever told will come back to me one day. If this rain keeps coming, we can wash the world away. This is not your hand. That is not my rib. This is not your farewell kiss. And those are not your lips. I became a writer. You became my wife. And I was not unhappy my whole life. So all the lies I've ever told, they're gonna come back to me one day. If this rain keeps coming, we can wash the world away. All the lies I've ever told come back to me one day. If this rain keeps coming, we can wash the world away. If it keeps coming, we can wash the world away. If it keeps coming, we'll just wash the world away. A while ago now, I made friends with a five-year-old by the name of Jasper, and I realized it was a while ago because I thought about, and he's got to be in high school by now. And he had figured out something interesting. He had figured out that if you use the construction do the blank, where blank is a noun, that means a dance craze. And he had set himself to the project of coming up with dance crazes. He had one called the snail, which is you get down on your knees and you kind of pull yourself forward with your hands. That was doing the snail. He had one called the pillow, which is you get down in the fetal position on the floor and you don't move at all. And then he had one called the struggle, which is you take a chair with a back and you put it up against the wall and you put the top of your head against the back of the chair and then you just run your feet as fast as you can and try and push the chair through the wall. That was doing the struggle. And I said, Jasper, you're a fucking genius. Because that reminds me of all my friends who are touring musicians and activists and podcasters and spend their time trying to push chairs through walls. So this is for them. It's called Do the Struggle. We had a spring fling in Flint Springs. Made some surprisingly fast life decisions. Got lost in all the rubble-strewn hills and yellow flowers in the heating grill. Windmill farm to Cate Divide. Hakumba to the Devil's Canyon. Roll your windows, stay inside. Rabbit shit on my heel. We spent the gay 90s in London. Passing out wolf tickets in abundance until we happened upon a shared mania for action, organized only by an abstract dissatisfaction. We thought just to break the tedium, we'd create the rapture with a sex doll and some helium. Ours to impress and destroy, defend and annoy. These days chaos for its own sake is at a premium. So they hung to the Eiffel Tower. Police came, they cut the power. We were a spectacle, we were cannon fodder. We were overboard and underwater. It was our worst day, it was our finest hour when we hung from the Eiffel Tower. And the Indian Ocean turned a tufted blue slate under the first storm clouds in 3 weeks. We ran an email scam with a Zanzibari Bezzy Blair with Antipodean char. Watch your wallet, sorry false alarm. Jack of diamonds, queen of spades. When your trick hits, it's disarray. And we overstayed our welcome, we sprayed fuck you on the runway when we ran away. Memorize the Marseillaise from when we hung from the Eiffel Tower. When the police came and they cut the power, we were a spectacle, we were cannon fodder. We were overboard and underwater. It was our worst day, it was our finest hour when we hung from the Eiffel Tower. They call a speed bump a prone policeman in Russia. We took that literally. No saxophones on Sunday in the South. We thought differently. Hey man, where's middle C? Cure your melancholia instantly. Get busy with infamy. It worked brilliantly. So please alert our families. And they said, is this a joke to you? Or a serious battle. We said when the monkey throws himself against the door, he doesn't care if it opens, long as it rattles. Scares the children, makes the parents gasp. We come not to demand, but to baffle. And if anyone asks you who or where we are, just tell the cops we're following a star. Tell the cops we're following a star. Following a star. And the critics said they were conceptual terrorists hanging there with Do the Struggle spelled out in lights on their chest. It was a dance sensation. They swing to the east and you swing to the west, and you blame it all on the bulletproof vests, and you do it all for the dispossessed. It's an elegant suggestion, an eloquent protest, but it's a mess. Hung themselves from the Eiffel Tower. The police came, they cut the power. They were a spectacle, they were cannon fodder. They were overboard and underwater. It was their worst day, it was their finest hour. And they hung from the Eiffel Tower. Thanks very much, everybody. My name's Franz Nicolai. Thanks, Steve, Dana, and Julia for having me.
Now is the moment in our podcast where we endorse Dana. Nah.
I like how it became a little song, sort of like some mimetic copying from Franz there.
Inspired by Franz.
Okay, before I endorse, I just want to read something that I really wanted to read in our C word segment, but we had so much to say that I never got around to it, which is, I mean, I think everybody here is probably a language person. If you like our show and you've stuck with us this long and you're coming all the way out to hear us, you care about language. So you have to know that the most interesting word spoken by Samantha Bee was, of course, not the C word, but feckless. So I just brought the etymology of feckless because it's so great. It was floating around online last week after everyone was talking about this. So the first usage of feck, or feckless, rather, is in the 1590s. It's from a Scottish word feck, F-E-C-K, which is actually a dialectical form of effect. So to say someone is feckless means that they have no effect, right? And there was also a positive form of the word feckful, someone who can have an effect. unlike Ivanka Trump. And one more note of the etymology of feckless. It was popularized by Carlyle. So much later, after the 1590s, we have the Victorian critic Thomas Carlyle, who started using feckless in his criticism and popularized it, kind of brought it back from the dead, whereas its opposite, feckful, then disappeared into the mists of linguistic history. So I really like that. And I think also that it really speaks to what the speech act of Samantha Bee was actually saying, which was the reason we think you're a see you next Tuesday is because you're not having any effect on the policy that you are in a position to be able to change. All right. But that's not my endorsement. My endorsement. I do want to endorse using that word as often as possible because it's a great word.
What about feckful? Let's bring that back.
Bring back feckful. That's a good. That's a really
the Scottish,
good
by the way, use the word feck in other contexts too.
Right. I mean, I think part of why feckless is such a great word is that it contains this kind of hidden, you know, kind of homophone for a curse word. But so my endorsement is a book related to our Philip Roth segment, which I think Julia just read as well. It's Asymmetry by Lisa Halliday. Anybody read it out there? Yeah. Elliot's a fan. Asymmetry is a relatively new book. I think it came out early this year. It's by Lisa Halliday. It's her first novel. And Lisa Halliday is a friend and I guess former lover, right? Somebody who was involved with Philip Roth in the past and remained friends with him afterwards, is much younger than him, as is, you know, the age difference in the story we just read. And in some ways, Asymmetry, I was thinking while reading The Ghostwriter, has some similarities to The Ghostwriter. It also is written in sections, three different sections that tell different stories from different points of view, where it's hard, just as with the Anne Frank segment of The Ghostwriter, it's hard to see how these pieces are going to fit together. And there's almost like a mystery twist kind of element to trying to see how the story of a young woman having an affair with an older writer, which is obviously somewhat of a Romana Clef for Lisa Halliday and Philip Roth's relationship, how that's going to fit in with the second kind of B story, which is the story of an Iraqi immigrant in the United States. And I won't say anything more than that because it is sort of a mystery, but it's a great read. It's a fun book to talk about afterwards. It's great to read it along with somebody else so that you can kind of revisit at the end and see what you make of the whole thing, because the pieces don't quite click into place. I mean, Asymmetry is the perfect title for it because it leaves you a little bit ambiguous about what exactly you just read and who is telling what story. Asymmetry by Lisa Halliday is a really nice companion piece if you're going to be either reading The Ghostwriter or some other Philip Roth.
I am halfway through it and reluctantly put it aside in order to start The Ghostwriter, to the point where I only just finished The Ghostwriter on the train up here. So I look forward to finishing it and discussing it with you.
Have you gotten to the
second part?
No,
I'm still. Right. I mean, I've read the jacket flap, so I'm aware that the second part exists, but I haven't gotten there yet.
Love it. Julia, what do you have?
I have a word. I have a word that's actually not unlike feckful. Does anyone in the audience speak German? All right, so maybe correct me when I pronounce this. This is a word I came across in a sub/quasi-endorsement, a wholehearted endorsement, but not my endorsement today, Matt Levine's newsletter. Matt Levine writes about finance for Bloomberg and has a daily newsletter about business and finance that's super interesting and illuminating. And in it, several weeks ago, he used a word I had never before encountered, a German word called Fingerspitzengefühl. That's my best fake German. How'd I do? All right, thumbs up. Thumbs up from the avowed German speaker. so-so from over here. How do you say it?
Fingerspitzengefühl.
All right, so more of a soft S and a long U. All right, so this, from what I glean, translates roughly to fingertips feeling, and it's a term that you can use to describe someone who has an intuitive flair or instinct or feel for the moment. The metaphor that someone shared with me was like the farmer feeling the soil and just having a sense of like what was in it and what would grow and what you could conjure from it, how you might feckfully use it, or sort of a situational awareness. And what a great term, especially if, as like me, you work in a field or an industry where data is constantly around you and people are constantly telling you should listen to this or that bit of data or analysis. But of course, every data-driven analysis is just somebody using evidence to make an argument. This sense of like a term that so perfectly captures just having an instinct about the moment. So great. Say it again. Wait, let me try. Let me see if I can learn. Fingerspitzengefühl. Better. Got a thumbs up. Okay.
Oh my God. That would have taken me months. I love it. When we were in Melbourne, we were hosted by the Wheeler Center, a cultural center that's sort of roughly analogous to the 92nd Street Y in New York City, I guess, the head of which, Michael Williams...
But hipper, I would say.
Yeah. No, I loved it. And the head of it, Michael, gave us each a book as a going-away present. And this really reminded me of what Phil Jackson, the NBA coach, used to do. He would give books to his players, especially, I think, to his star players, especially, I think, to Kobe Bryant, to try and get in their heads from a slightly oblique or unexpected angle. And there was pregnant allegorical significance to the books that he gave them. And I felt like this is what Michael was doing. And then I read it, and the book that he gave me is about two women imprisoned by a psychopath. I was like, you read me, dude. What can I say? It's an extraordinary piece of literature called The Watchtower by Elizabeth Harrow. Are there any Elizabeth Harrow fans here? All right, you have an incredible discovery ahead of you. She's an Australian writer. I think she was writing many decades ago, if I had to guess, from the post-war up until the 70s. She had a renaissance a couple years ago because she's one of these people who, in I believe 1971, at the last minute withdrew what was to be her last book from publication. She said, I actually don't want to publish this book, and disappeared from literary reality completely. She's still alive. In 2014, she was coaxed into publishing the withdrawn book and had a little bit of a renaissance. James Wood, the literary critic for The New Yorker, wrote about Harrow. I believe it's a profile of her, essentially, on the occasion of this book. I was astonished at the virtuosity of it and the savagery of it. And it's also, it's about the state of mind that you go into as a defense against an highly arbitrary, autocratic person who essentially controls your inner and outer life. And it's just perfectly observed and riveting as a genre novel up until the last page. It does something which I won't spoil that I've never seen a literary book or any book really do before. I mean, talk about the question of who's the actual hero or heroine. I couldn't recommend it highly enough. It's called The Watchtower by Elizabeth Harrow. You must read it. It's your new assignment. We will meet here next year for the second annual Steve-a-Palooza. Thank you, Dana.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Julia.
Thank you.
You will find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page at slate.com/culturefest. You can email us at culturefest@slate.com or drop us a note on Facebook at Facebook, whatever it is, with Facebook, around Facebook, at facebook.com/culturefest. We have a Twitter feed. It's @SlateCultFest. Our producer is Benjamin Frisch. Our production assistant is Daniel Schrader. I would like to thank very much Franz Nicolai and Red Haired Stranger for playing music. It enhanced everyone's experience. And I would like to get down on my knees and thank SNS Brewery for maintaining, sustaining this kingdom and filling it with music and suds. This place is amazing. I knew the instant I pulled up the first time we were going to do a live show here. Give it up for SNS Brewery, Nassau, New York. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the conclusion. Oh my God, Faith and Faith, without whom this whole thing couldn't possibly happen. The event coordinator of Slate.com. Oh my God.
Can I give, just indulge one more minute? So those of you who listen closely may know that Steve tried to goad us into being interested in this place, and we shunned him. And he was like, no, I'm going to take you there. I'm going to plan a secret live show. And I was like, uh-huh, sure. And then he was like, I've got Faith in cahoots with me. And I was like, oh, damn. We're really going to Rensselaer County if Faith is planning this thing. So Faith makes amazing things happen.
Faith.
Like every day.
The eponymous.
Thank you, Faith.
Thank you. All right, give it up. Thank you so much for coming. We really appreciate you making the time and effort to join us. That was great.
I'm always working on the train, laying down steel rail, shovel coal in the rain. I'm always working all night and day. I'm always working, breaking up heavy stone. Day is done on my back, don't leave me alone. Back work, working all 9 days. Yeah, to give me a dollar and I can't change that shit.